Well, I'm Father Darrell, and I'm an alcoholic. And a 39-year-old spiritual giant. Can you hear me okay? I'll bet you can. I bet you could if we turned this thing off, too. But I'm glad to be here tonight. I appreciate Don asking me to do this. I didn't appreciate it when he asked me to do it, but this is good for me. I need to be up here. I've got a big book here I've got marked up, so I'll be referring to it throughout my talk tonight, because everything I know about Alcoholics Anonymous, I got out of this big book, usually through somebody else. But I was thinking when I was sitting over there, Paul called me Father Darrell. He told me earlier I look like a priest. My wife said I look like a pimp. So I guess it's all a matter of perception, isn't it? And believe me, she knows me a lot better than Paul does. But I'm here tonight to try to tell you my story, and I'm going to try to stick to the format that I learned out of this book, and I've learned since I've been a member of this program, which, by the way, has been since late November of 1984. And there used to be an old-timer here when I got here, a very wise old man, been sober for 100 years. And I heard him say one time that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we do not teach, preach, counsel, or advise anybody about anything. We share our experience, strength, and hope with each other. And I'm going to try to stick to that tonight. But the truth is, I get a little preachy, so bear with me here. Isn't it really? But this book says that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And so that's basically what I'm going to try to stick with here tonight. My story is exactly the same as everybody else's in this room, I promise you. If you overlook the details and, you know, if you, all of our stories are the same, I really believe. I tried to drink and I couldn't. I tried to quit and I couldn't. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I've been all right ever since. And that's basically my story. I tried long and hard to drink. I tried everything that I could conjure up that would allow me to drink, and nothing worked. Absolutely nothing. Paul said I talked about drugs, and I do. It's part of my story. I can't help it. But I'm going to try to not to get too deep into that, but it's part of my story. Hell, it was, you know, back in the 60s, he was talking about I was 5 years old, you know. But I've heard the big boys down at the pool room talking about these things, you understand? But anyway, what I used to be like is in this book, just like everything else about my life can be found in this book. And this says in here, on page 52, and y'all tell me if you can identify with any of this. I'll paraphrase it here just a little. I was having trouble with personal relationships. I couldn't control my emotional nature. I was a prey to misery and depression. I couldn't make a living. I had a feeling of uselessness. I was full of fear and I was unhappy. Now that's the description of me when I got here. That's exactly what I was. And what I'm like now, I'm wonderful. Basically, I'm wonderful, by God. I'm a spiritual giant. But what I'm like now is also in this book. And this is not 100% of the time, you understand. But every once in a while, I know a new freedom and a new happiness. I do not regret the past nor wish to shut the door upon it. I comprehend the word serenity and I know peace. My whole attitude and outlook upon life has changed, and I realize that God is doing for me what I cannot do for myself. Now that's the way I feel when I am into this program the way I'm supposed to be, when I'm trying to live these principles in my life, which I manage to do about 5 minutes a day. And then I get up. But anyway, in this book, in Bill's story, Bill says something that really, it struck me the first time I read it. Bill says, I discovered liquor. And I got to thinking about that, and I honestly cannot tell you when I discovered liquor. I don't know when I had my first drink of alcohol. I was raised in a family that drank. They drank a lot, and they drank often. And as a result of that, there was always booze in the house. And I was the oldest of six very rowdy boys, and we were into everything. And so at a very early age, we were sneaking beers and a drink here. And I can remember one incident when I couldn't have been 9 or 10 years old, and one of my uncles got me drunk on cheap wine. I remember that very well. And I remember being extremely sick from it. But, you know, I was not an alcoholic, apparently, at that time, because there was no craving for alcohol. There was no obsession to drink it again that I can recall. But at an early age, on my 13th birthday, I can tell you exactly when it was. I don't have to go back and look at a calendar. I remember it quite well. I discovered the effects of liquor. And that's a whole different world. Discovering liquor may be one thing, but I discovered the effects of liquor. Dr. Silkworth says in our book here that that's why we drink. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. And that's what I did. I discovered those effects. I loved it immediately, and it changed my life. It changed my life, and it never changed again until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But in this book, in the chapter of Vision for You, it talks about those effects. And he describes these effects in here. He says, for most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy and a feeling that life is good. And now that's the way I felt when I drank alcohol. This is a description, I think, of what non-alcoholic, normal drinkers feel when they drink alcohol. And that's what I felt as well. That's what I felt every time I drank it. And it lasted anywhere from 5 seconds to 5 minutes. And I was through that, and then I was on into the idiocy, the stupidity of alcoholism, the drunkenness. But because I'm an alcoholic, I've got other effects from alcohol. I got these effects that he describes here, absolutely. But I got other effects from alcohol. I got effects from alcohol that other non-alcoholic people probably don't get. And some of those effects were my first drunk. When I discovered the effects of alcohol on my 13th birthday, I found a bottle of Jim Beam whiskey in the alley behind my house in New Mexico. And I snuck it into a movie that night. Me and two or three other boys went to the movies, and we snuck this bottle of whiskey into the movie with us. And we drank it. We proceeded to drink it all, I guess, in that movie. And it made me horribly sick. I remember that. I puked on everybody in spewing range of me in that theater that night. It was absolutely a horrible experience. I was carried home and poured in the door feet first, and my dad got up, and just, it was a terrible experience. It was a horrible experience. And I spent the next 21 years of my life trying to recapture the great moments of that night, you know. And I was generally successful. Most of my drinking ended up exactly like that. But these effects I was talking about that I get from alcohol, I get when I drink alcohol. I got drunk that night at 13. I spent my first night in jail when I was 14 from a drunken incident. I quit school and left home when I was 15. My parents divorced, and I left home and never went back. I was diagnosed an alcoholic the first time at 16. I got my first DWI when I was 17. I was shot and almost killed in a drunken brawl when I was 18. And do you begin to see a pattern developing here? This was the story of my life right here. This was the pattern that my life followed right there. Drink, trouble, drink, trouble, drink, trouble. Never any different. Almost every time I ever drank alcohol, it caused me a problem. It caused me some kind of a problem. Sometimes it was a big problem, sometimes it was a small problem, but it was always a problem. But I continued to drink it. And when I was 21 years old, I was carried feet first into an insane asylum out in West Texas, the Big Spring State Hospital. I was in DTs, I was in convulsions, and I was down there. I'd almost drank myself to death at that tender age. And that was where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was in this nut house. And at that time, I don't know what it's like in these places now. I hadn't been in one in a long time, thank God. But at that time, that was 1971, the alcoholics in these hospitals worked on the mental wards. That's, you know, we swept the floors and what have you. And the state gave us, I think it was $1 a day for doing this, which was enough to buy a pack of cigarettes and a candy bar. You know, it was not a bad deal for everybody. But You were you had to attend AA meetings. A lot of two or three a day you were supposed to go to. Plus we had, I guess you'd call it AA classes. We had classes where we discussed this book, and you know, we had a counselor who made notes, and it was just like going to a college class on this big book. It was probably pretty good stuff if anybody had been interested in it, which I was not. But the people in that institution insisted that we go to AA meetings, and alcoholics who did not attend these meetings on a regular basis were considered to be uncooperative. And the people at Big Springs had a way of dealing with people who were uncooperative. They knew how to make you cooperate. And their method was electric shock treatments. And my first job in this place was strapping people to a gurney and wheeling them in to get these shock treatments. So I was watching this firsthand. And I knew right away I didn't want anything to do with it. So every time there was an AA meeting in that hospital, I was sitting right there in the front row, you know, because I knew what happened to people who were uncooperative and didn't do what they were supposed to do. But anyway, after 90 days, I left that institution. I don't know. I think it's supposed to be 30 days or something, but I stayed in there for 90 days, and they let me out and sent me to a halfway house, which lasted about one day, and I was drunk, and they kicked me out of the halfway house. But that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the truth is, when I left that hospital, I probably knew as much about the disease of alcoholism as any layman in the country did. Hell, I'd had a 90-day course in it. And you know, I had to learn. But it didn't do me any good. It didn't keep me sober. All this knowledge about the illness did nothing for me, except it allowed me in later years to sit in bars and diagnose the alcoholics. Yeah, really. And I was probably right most of the time. You know, I'd say, look at that guy over there. You see that compulsion has kicked in on this man over here. But anyway, when I got out of that institution, it was more the same. It was right on back, same old thing, in trouble all the time, constantly in and out of jail. And things got a little bit warm. Things got a little hot. I bounced around from several states, from state to state at that time. And I heard old Joe Lee say one time, when he got here in 1950, he was wanted in two states and unwanted in 46 others. And that's about the way I found myself. I was unwanted in a whole lot of places and wanted in more than one. And so I had been working in the oil field for a number of years, since I was 15 years old. And this opportunity came along for me to go overseas and work. So, you know, it sounded, the money was good. There were no policemen over there looking for me. And so it sounded like a pretty good deal. And so I signed on the dotted line and went over and spent a couple of years in Africa and then on to other places. But I wound up working for this company for about almost 20 years in various places around the world. And this company was a very large drilling contractor, and they had operations in, I don't know, 40 or 50 countries around the world. And they had a novel way of dealing with alcoholism. I guess they thought they had the cure for it, and I guess it worked pretty well. But whenever they had someone like me, and they had quite a few people like me on their payroll, I never knew of them firing anybody. That was not their method of dealing with it. Their method was to move you around. You know, when you got so bad they couldn't stand you here, they'd transfer you to another country somewhere halfway around the world. And that's the way they did with me. And like I say, there were a number of us in this company with this problem, and we would pass each other, you know, and you get to know these guys over the years. But a pattern developed. I would go to a new country, a new job, and man, I would say, this is it. I'm going to do what's right this time. We're not going to get into these binds and have these problems again like I just came from there. I'm going to control this drinking, and I'm going to do what's right. And by God, I meant it. I was serious, too. I was going to do it. And I would for probably a month. And then we'd start on this downhill slide again. You know, a few months later, here I am going to the airport with my suitcases, going to the next job because the people there couldn't take me anymore. And everywhere I went, I had this black cloud over my head. That went on for years and years like that. And somebody told me the other night, when I tell my story, it sounds like a travel log, and I'm going to try not to do that. But anyway, but anyway, in 1982, I believe it was, I found myself, going back further than that, 1975, I guess, I found myself in Bolivia, in South America. And by the time I got there, I was 25, 26 years old, and my alcoholism had progressed pretty well. I mean, I was on down the road pretty well. And I'd reached a point where, hell, I couldn't drink hardly anything, just a few drinks, and I'd get drunk and I'd pass out. And I'd wake up a few more drinks and pass out again, and it was really interfering with my job and, you know, my social life and a few other things. And somebody introduced me to a miracle drug that they produce in that part of the world in great quantities. And this was a white powder. And you took this white powder and you snorted it up in your nose, and damn, all at once you could drink as much as anybody. Absolutely the truth. I could outdrink any of them as long as I had a supply of this miracle drug. And a supply was not hard to maintain in that country at that time. And that was my introduction to cocaine. And I loved it. Hell, it was a big part of my life for several years after that. And I made sure that I stayed in that part of the world because of that. But in 1982, I wound up in Peru. And let me tell you, all these other countries, everywhere else in the world, I'd been in Colombia and Venezuela, and I'd been in Bolivia, and all these drug countries down in South America. And all of them were just a prep school to get you ready for Peru. That's all it was. Because, brother, those people down there knew how to make that stuff. Now, but I had a job. I worked out in the Amazon jungle. And I was a very important person, you understand. Don't ask me why, but I was a very important person on this job. And I was looking after about 10 drilling rigs. And I'd go out to this jungle, and I'd stay 2 weeks in this base camp, and I'd stay drunk and stoned for 2 weeks. And the men on these rigs would take care of business. They ran their jobs. Of course, there was nothing I could do to help them anyway. I was out of it. But anyway, this went on for 2 years like this. And then I would go back to Lima, where I lived, for 2 weeks of R&R. And for 2 weeks in Lima, I would stay drunk and stoned. And then it was back to the jungle for 2 weeks, and this went on like this. And at the end of 2 years, I was pretty much a wreck. You know, there wasn't much left of me, mentally at least. But I was in Iquitos, Peru in 1984. I was in Peru a couple of years. And I was in a place in the jungle called Iquitos. It's a good-sized city on the Amazon River. And in scientific terms, it would be called a shithole. It's really, really a bad place, let me tell you. Except that they had a whole bunch of this miracle drug that I needed so badly. But anyway, I was leaving a disco one night in the company of some people I should not have been with, and I got arrested on the streets of Iquitos. And this is not really ordinarily a big deal. I've been arrested in several countries before that. It was never a big deal. A few dollars, and everything was okay, and you went your way. But that night in Iquitos, things were a little different. One thing, I was extremely belligerent and refused to play the game, and all they wanted was my watch. That's all it took, my watch. They wanted my watch, and had I given them my watch, I could have gone my way and even kept my dope and gone on. But no, I couldn't do that. And I told them there was nothing they could do to me, and so they proceeded to show me there was something they could do to me. They locked me up in jail, and I stayed in jail there for 2 or 3 days, which was a very bad deal because the company gets involved when you don't show up for work, you understand. But after I'd been in there 2 or 3 days, I talked to this lawyer, and he said, no problem at all. He said, give me $1,500, and I'll have you out of here like that. I said, okay, no problem. So I gave him the money, and good as his word, he had me out of there that same day. They moved me from that jail to the prison. And that's where I stayed for the next few months. But normally, these things are not a big deal, seriously. Normally, these things are taken care of fairly easily with a little money. You know, that's the end of it. And of course, I would have lost my job, but I would have been on out and gone on. But things were different in Peru at this time. There were some things going on. The U.S. government was pressuring the Peruvian government really big time to crack down on this drug trade. And I came along just at the right time to get swept up in this thing. And so there was no fixing this. They took me down, and they filed all the formal charges and all this stuff against me. Anyway, the bottom line was, the path I was on, I was going to go back to court. They would give me a 30-year sentence, and then that would be the end of it. And there's no bond, there's no appeals, there's none of that sort of thing. 30 years in prison down there, and that was the end of it. But because of the pressure being exerted by the U.S. government, the Peruvians changed their laws or their regulations concerning prisoners in their penal system. And they had a system like ours, really, what we call good time. And they had something down there along that line. And a 30-year sentence, you actually stayed 15 years and you were out. And then in response to this pressure from the U.S. government, they changed all that with a stroke of a pen. And they made this retroactive. I mean, here's people in this prison with me who've been in there 15 years and overdue to get out because of the lateness of the paperwork. And overnight, they've got another 15 years to go. And this was kind of a shock to these folks, as you can imagine. And they were not happy with it. And to make a long story short, we burned the prison down. And to show them that we didn't like this, by God, we burned down the roof over our heads. Of course, what we didn't burn down was the wall around the prison. We didn't go anywhere. All this meant was we now slept out in the rain, but anyway, things got really, really seriously bad in this prison. And, nobody was getting out of here. Nobody got out of there. Nobody came in. I mean, families and all this, visits, there was nothing. We'd burned all these barracks down, and we were sleeping inside. I had about an 8-foot chain link fence around each barrack. And there was a 15-foot brick wall around all of this. And so now we're sleeping inside this chain link enclosure like a bunch of animals sleeping on the ground in the rain. And it was like a scene. It was like a scene out of a madhouse. I mean, it was crazy. And we had a drink that we made in the prison out of paint thinner. I'm not for sure. I think they ran paint thinner through their dirty underwear, and what came out was drinkable. But then they had a dope in there that was some dregs of the cocaine refining process, and it was all it was some mind-bending stuff, let me tell you all of it. But this was our daily bread in here. And I was sitting with my back to that chain-link fence one night and watching all this insanity go on around me with no hope of getting out of there ever in this life. And I'm a lifelong atheist at this point. Now, I was a stone atheist all my life. I could prove to you 100 different ways why God didn't exist. And I believed it, I guess. But somebody said one time that there are no atheists in foxholes. And I was in a foxhole, I guess. Because I was sitting in there that night with my back up against this chain link fence and just despairing of anything. I mean, my life was finished. My life was over. I'd already told my wife to get the kids and go back to the States, to go home, because there was nothing. It was over. And I was sitting there that night like that, and I don't know why I did this, because desperation, obviously. But I uttered a prayer. I prayed. And the way I prayed, I said, God, if you exist, get me the hell out of here. And then I passed out shortly after that. And I woke up the next morning, and lo and behold, I'm still in this prison. You know, I was not transported over the walls during the night. But strangely enough, that afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon or so, the guards came back to this enclosure I was in, and they said, Gringo, come with us. And I went up to the administration building at the front, and there was my wife. And she had a piece of paper in her hand that she had bribed a Supreme Court justice for with quite a bit of money. That gave me a 1-week reprieve from that prison. It allowed me to leave that prison for 1 week. And I was not allowed to leave the city of Iquitos, of course. And in 1 week, I had a hearing to determine what they were going to do with me. And I don't know how that hearing went, but I heard it didn't go well. But since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have become a spiritual giant. And I've decided that I owe an amend to the people of Peru, because I was guilty. I was guilty of sin. There's no question about it. I broke their laws. They had every right to do what they wanted to with me. So I've decided that I'm going to go back to Peru, and I'm going to turn myself in to to those people. Just as soon as I am totally and completely cured of alcoholism. In the meantime, I'm too sick. I've got to stay right here. But anyway, my wife and children, we came home hurriedly, to say the least. We came home. But, you know, any semi-normal human being after an experience like that, and what I'd been through all my life up to that point, would might begin to understand there's a problem here, you know. You might begin to question what's going on. Why do these things continue to happen to me? But when I came back home, nothing changed. I continued to drink. I continued to do every kind of drug I could get in my mouth. And this went on for another several months after I got home. And I was unemployable. There was no way I could get a job. I'd had this job for all these years. And I had no idea how far down I had gone physically and mentally. But I would walk in to talk to somebody about a job. And man, you know, the shades would come down immediately. The position had just been filled as soon as he laid eyes on me, because I was as crazy as a bedbug. But anyway, my wife got a job, and we had some money and savings, and that's the way I managed to stay drunk for the next 5 or 6 months, 4 months, however long it was. And on November the 25th, 1984, I got up off the, or no, November the 24th, let me back up. I got up off the floor, which was my usual sleeping place. My wife slept in the bedroom, and I slept in the living room floor normally, where I'd pass out. You know, I'd get up and start drinking, and I'd pass out, and I'd drink, and I'd pass out, and this went on around the clock, basically. But on November the 24th, 1984, I got up off that floor, and I started again. The same thing. I started drinking, and I got drunk, and I passed out, and I woke up, and I drank some more. And then the following, about midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, it'll be the 25th of November here, I woke up in a house over in North Tower. I had no clue who that house belonged to, how I got there, nothing about it. But I woke up on the couch in the living room, and I could hear people snoring. I know there was somebody back there somewhere. But I got up, and I was creeping out of the house. And there was a bottle of Mad Dog 2020 sitting up on the cabinet. I grabbed that as I went out the door. And I drank that between that house in North Tyler and my house in White House. And as I was turning into my driveway in White House that morning at 5 o'clock, I think it was, I killed the last of that bottle of Mad Dog and threw it out the window. And I had no idea at the time, but that was my last drink of alcohol to date so far. But I went in and passed out on the floor. Everything's normal. Nothing's changed. November the 25th, I woke up on that floor and something had changed. And I have no idea what it was. There's no describing it. I'm sure most of you know what it was without me telling you, but it happened to me while I was passed out. When I woke up that morning on that floor, something had changed. Something had clicked, and I knew I could not do this anymore. I have never been so miserable in all my life. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, the book calls it. And that's exactly the state I was in that morning when I got up off that floor. And I knew. But we talk about a moment of clarity, and I guess that's what I had. Because I knew that if I took that drink I wanted so bad, the cycle would start again. I would drink until I passed out, and I would get up and drink some more. And when I got up off that floor, I knew that. You know, this book tells us that if an alcoholic drinks long enough, he will eventually reach the point to where he cannot imagine his life with or without alcohol. And that's exactly where I was that morning. Because I could not imagine not drinking. But on the other hand, I could not imagine taking another drink of alcohol and starting this all over again. And all my life up to this point, my whole world had revolved around alcohol. Alcohol was the center of my universe. Hell, I didn't make a plan. I didn't do anything without factoring in alcohol. It was my life. And so I could not imagine my life without alcohol. But when I got up off that floor that morning, I could no longer imagine going on the way I was going. And for the next week, I stayed sober on a combination of fear and willpower and I don't know what. But I literally walked in a circle around a drink. It was all I could think of was a drink. And at the end of a week, I knew that I was not going to stay sober. I knew that whatever it took, I didn't have it. The necessary resources, I did not have. But This was 13 years after I had left this insane asylum in West Texas in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd had no contact with AA in all those years in between. But at the end of that week sober, I knew what I had to do, because it was all right there. We talk about planting the seed. That seed was planted in 1971, and in 1984, it flowered, I guess, because I picked up the telephone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the guy answered the phone. I came to know him pretty well. His name was Frank I, and he was working at Central Service that morning, and he answered the telephone. Frank had been sober, I think, about 18 months at that time, and I was just babbling, and I couldn't even talk. I was just, it was really, you know, I was bad. And Frank listened to this for a while, and he said, "Well, do you think you have a drinking problem?" And I said, "No, of course not, you idiot. I have PMS. What do you, the hell do you think I have? What do you think I'm talking about?" But Frank gave me directions to Lake Street. And so I got in my car, and I came down here. Oh, no, it was a Sunday morning. And I came down here to the Sunday morning meeting, and I drove out about a half a tank of gas circling this building, you know. A lot of us have done that. But I watched people coming in, going in the building and parking, and I finally pulled in out here somewhere and parked and came in here. And there used to be a Coke machine right back there, and I sat back there by that Coke machine that morning. And I sat there, and I stared at my shoes and felt sorry for myself for 1 hour. And I have no idea what was said at that meeting. I don't know who was there, but I know that I sat there, and as soon as it was over, I made a break for the door, and this big, tall drink of water named Pat W. intercepted me before I could get out the door. Pat caught me. He put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, "I know how you feel. We're glad you're here. Come on back." And then I made the fatal mistake of giving Pat my phone number. If you come in here and you don't mean business, don't ever make that mistake, because these damn people will hound you to death. That's what Pat did. He hounded me to meeting after meeting after meeting. And it got to where and I lived way off out the other side of White House. Pat would call me and say, "You going to a meeting tonight?" Pat, I'll meet you down there. And there's something in my voice, I guess, warned him. And he'd say, "No, let me come pick you up." And he would drive all the way out and get me, and we'd go to a meeting. But I stayed sober. I stayed sober day after day by coming to these meetings and by talking to people like Pat and other people that I began to meet in these meetings. And I heard something, you know. I heard something here. I mean, I did not rush in here and get well, let me assure you. But I heard something. There was something that kept me coming back here. And I've thought about it in the years since, and I've come to believe that something in this room made me believe that there was hope, there was help for me. And I guess that's the second step, you know, came to believe. And I came to believe, and I came back. But I stayed sober around here for a number of months just by going to meetings, basically, and talking to drunks. But that was all I did. I'm still an atheist, you know. I don't believe in all this damn stuff. But I came back to these meetings, and when people would talk about God, oh, I'd just bristle. Ah, just infuriate me when people would do that. But I kept coming back to these meetings. And shortly after I got sober, you have to remember, I'd been working overseas for years. And things like paying your income taxes, filing these tax returns, get to be a bit of a nuisance, you know. So about 10 years prior to this, I just stopped doing it. And I'd been sober for 17 days. And I got a letter from the Internal Revenue Service. I'll never forget it. And I opened it up, and it says, "Mr. Henson, basically, we know who you are and what you've done, and we're coming to get you, by God." I said, "Oh, my God, here we go. Here I am trying to do right, and these bastards just won't leave me alone, you know." So this group I'd been going to over here at Medical Center Hospital, there was this guy in there that I'd been paying attention to, because he had what I wanted. He had what I wanted. He had money. He had a Cadillac car. You know, he had all kinds of stuff. I wanted everything he had. But he was a lawyer, I come to find out. And it turned out all at once, I needed a lawyer. So I waylaid this guy outside the meeting one night, and I said, "Look, I got a problem." I said, I need some legal help. And I explained to him what the situation was. He said, "Come to my office." He said, "Bring your passport, bring every document you can find, and bring a check for a whole bunch of money." And he said, "I'll help you." So I did. I showed up at his office with all the requirements. and gave it all to him, and he told me, he said, "Now, you go home and forget about this." He said, "Now it's in my hands. It's my job. I'll take care of it. You forget about it. You concentrate on staying sober." And so I went off and I did that. I actually just forgot all about it. And just a little aside here, just to prove the point up to you that you never know where these things are going to lead, where anything in this that happens to you, this program is going to take you. 6 months after giving all this stuff to that lawyer, I got another letter from the Internal Revenue Service. When I opened it up, there was a check for $15,000 inside. Go figure, huh? But anyway, that worked out so well, I asked that lawyer to be my sponsor. I said, "Shit, if he can do that, I need this guy." But that guy is still my sponsor. He's the only sponsor I've had in 18 years, and he's still my sponsor today. But he is not a lawyer like you think of lawyers. Everybody talks about greedy lawyers. My sponsor is not like that. My sponsor gives me a discount on my sponsor fees. He doesn't charge me the full amount like everybody else. But anyway, here I am staying sober. Like I say, I stayed sober for a number of months, just on coming to meetings and doing nothing else. And I kept hearing people say strange things like, "Boy, if you don't work these steps, you're going to get drunk." And that went in this ear and out that one. Because what I heard them say was, "You better get baptized or you're going to get drunk." But things had gotten bad. Things were getting bad in my life. I mean, I was getting miserable. I was unhappy. I was losing my mind, I truly believe. I was in a meeting right in here one day at noon, and I'll never forget it. It was in the winter, a beautiful winter day. And I was sitting in that meeting, and life was good. Oh, everything was just wonderful. God, I just was so happy. I was sober, and I had this $15,000 check, and I was just, life was good. 2 hours later, I was sitting up against a pine tree in my backyard, bawling like a baby, just weeping. And I had no idea why. Absolutely nothing had changed. Nothing had changed. But I was sitting there crying and bawling. And I remember thinking, so this is what it's like to go insane. Because that's what I thought was happening. I had no idea. I didn't realize I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. But long about this time, somebody gave me a tape that literally changed my life. And it was a tape by a person we all know and love, Clancy I. And in this tape, in this talk Clancy made out here at Harvey Hall, in this talk, Clancy said something that absolutely changed my life and just jerked me up. And what he said was this. He said, "If your problem is alcohol, I'm going to tell you something that will revolutionize your life. Quit drinking. That's all you have to do. If alcohol is your problem, you quit drinking alcohol, you've removed the problem, and your life will immediately begin to get better. But," he said, "if you're an alcoholic, that is not the case, because alcohol is not your problem. Alcohol is your solution. And if you remove alcohol from an alcoholic, you've removed the only solution he's ever had. And his life begins to get worse. And it continues to get worse until you do one of two things. Drink or work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous." And damn, what a revelation that was to me. And I'd probably heard this very same thing 100 times in these rooms, but it did not register. When I heard Clancy, it registered. And so I made a decision when I heard that tape. I literally made a decision that I was going to try to work these steps. And I went to my sponsor and we talked about it. Of course, you know, he'd only told me the same thing 1,000 times. But I went to him and we sat down and I did a fourth step and we did a fifth step. And lo and behold, things started to happen. Let me tell you, I'll never forget it. Up until this time, there'd been very few days go by that I hadn't thought about taking a drink. Almost every day I thought about a drink. I went over to my sponsor's house one night with my fourth step, and we sat there until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning doing a fifth step. And when I left his house, you know, I was mentally and I was emotionally exhausted. You know, doing a fifth step is a very exhausting thing. And I was exhausted. I was very tired when I left there. I remember that. But that I felt nothing. I didn't feel any different. But about 2 weeks after doing this fifth step, I'm driving down Highway 69. I had a job by this time, by the way. And I was on my way to work. And I looked up, and there was a billboard on the side of the highway. And when I saw that billboard, it literally made the hair on my neck stand up. That billboard was advertising beer or whiskey or cocaine or something to that effect. And when I saw that billboard, I realized that I had not thought about a drink for 2 weeks since doing this fifth step. It had not entered my mind. But it had been such a subtle thing, I had not been aware of it until I saw that sign. But when I saw that sign, it made me think, it made me truly believe that maybe I could stay sober. Maybe this program would work for me like people claimed it worked for them. And maybe I could make it. And so here we go. You know, the great adventure of Alcoholics Anonymous. Damn, and it was too. And it still is today. But I stayed sober for a year. And my sponsor told me, he said, well, you've been sober a long time. A lot longer than anybody ever thought you'd be sober. He said, now it's time for you to start sponsoring people. You need to find somebody, if it's possible, find somebody in worse shape than you are and see if you can help him. And so I started sponsoring people. And I started sponsoring a lot of people, actually. And that's when I became an AA guru, you see. And I started teaching AA. But that's okay. That was all right. I look back on it now and I see that that's fine. I stayed sober. Nobody else did. None of these people I sponsored stayed sober. But I stayed sober. But when I was 2 years sober, I started to have some financial problems. The oil business had gone to hell, and I'd lost my job, and everything was just terrible. And I was really, really going downhill emotionally and mentally, worried, and you know the picture. But I had an old Cadillac car that I used to get back and forth to work. This old car was as old as I am, had about 1,000,000 miles on it. And one day this old car placed itself beyond human aid. It just laid down for the final count, and there was no reviving it. And here I am, I depend on this car to get to work. I have no money. And, you know, jobs are very hard to find. And so that was it. I'll never forget. I was in my driveway when this car cratered, and I said, well, that's it. That's the end of this. By God, I don't have to take this. I'm going to have a drink, and I'm going to relax. And I meant it. 2 years sober, and I meant it as much as I've ever meant anything. And turns out there was no booze in the house. There was nothing, absolutely nothing. And before I could get in my wife's car and go to the county line and buy something, this woman who went to the group that I went to, and I only knew her to speak to, I didn't know her well, only knew her about to speak to at the meetings, she was lost of all things, and she had driven by my house and saw me standing in the driveway and pulled in. This woman had 15 years in this program at that time. And make a long story short, she and I sat at my kitchen table until 3 o'clock in the morning talking about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not go get that drink. Another of these little coincidences that you run into over and over in this program. But Julie and I sat there until 3 o'clock in the morning talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And she told me things that, you know, strange things I'd never thought of. During our conversation, she said, well, have you worked the sixth and seventh steps today? And I said, oh, hell, I did that months ago. And she said, you really don't understand what we do here, do you? She said, the food you ate several months ago will not nourish you today. And the steps you worked several months ago will not keep you sober today. You have a daily reprieve, and you must do certain things on a daily basis if you want to get better. But, you know, just, it really, I was astounded. I couldn't imagine such a thing. You know, I was expected to do these steps over and over. My God. But things continued to get worse in my life, financially and otherwise. Personally, I was having a lot of personal problems. My wife, for some reason, still to this day, believes that she's as smart as I am. I cannot disabuse the woman of that damn notion. But anyway, we were having problems, a lot of problems. And ever since I'd been in this program, I'd heard people in these rooms say, well, I asked God to help me, and he did, and everything's been better ever since. And I'd never done that, and I had no intentions of doing that. You see, I had the idea that if this God, this higher power, would keep me sober, I would take care of the rest of it. I would manage my life, by God, to suit myself, thank you. I was perfectly capable of doing this. And that was the attitude that I had toward life and toward this program. And I had never asked God for help. I had given him directions on a number of occasions. You know, I'd pointed out to him what I really needed and how I needed it done. But I'd never asked him for help. And one night, I was standing in my living room. And I hope I never forget this. I was standing in my living room, and I was finished. I was done. I was at the end of my tether. I could not go on anymore. I was finished. Life had beaten me down, and I guess I surrendered. Because I was standing in my living room, and I had tears running down my face. And I said, God, please help me. And I didn't say, God, help me by doing this, or help me by giving me that. I just said, God, please help me. And that's all I said. And that's, I didn't care what happened. I had to have some relief. And almost at once, a feeling of well-being and peace came over me. Like it's, if you haven't experienced it, there's no way to describe it. Except that instantly, I knew that everything was going to be all right. Job or no job, wife or no wife, money or no money, everything was going to be all right. And it was all right. Believe it or not, things turned out. You know, it's 16 years later, tonight, 16 years after that incident in my living room, and I don't suppose I have ever actually thought for a minute that it was not going to be all right. And there's been the ups and downs, you know, life is like that. And I've had a lot of problems in the last 16 years. Financial problems, personal problems, health problems, on and on and on. But I always knew that it would be okay. That there was a power out there who would look after this. And it's been that way ever since. But in the last 16 years in this program, since that night, I have started to learn how to function in society. I've started to learn how to live like a normal, productive human being. And that's something I've come to believe, that's something that other people learn in puberty, you know, or prior to that maybe. I was 40 years old when I started learning these things. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult to grow up when you're middle-aged. But I have learned in the 16 years since then, some things that I don't hear enough. I don't hear much, really, it seems. I have learned that I am powerless over alcohol, but I am not powerless over my life. I am not powerless over the things that I do in this life and the things that happen to me in this life. I've come to believe that I am no longer a powerless, helpless victim. You see, that all stopped that night in my living room. I know now that I have been given a power, and I've used this power a number of times to improve my life and make things better for me. And I know it can be done. A few years ago, I got hurt on the job, and I was in a hell of a shape. Let me tell you, things were bad around my house. Couldn't work, no money. I mean, things were seriously bad. And I'll tell you a quick story about this. You know, I told you about the $15,000 that came from the Internal Revenue. Well, after I got hurt, my wife and I were living out at Bullard. And I mean, I was seriously fixing to go to Path or somewhere, by God, and try to get some food. It was that bad. And we had just bought 4 acres out there not too long before this happened to me. And we're walking along through the weeds this high. We're walking along through these weeds, and I kicked a bucket, a 5-gallon plastic bucket, sitting out here in these weeds. And this plastic bucket was filled, heaped up with pennies. Now, what in the hell those pennies were doing out in the middle of that field, I have no idea. But there they were, a 5-gallon bucket of pennies. And we lugged these pennies back up to the house and started rolling them up, and there was over $200 worth of damn pennies there. But, which kept the wolf away until, you know, some other things could take place. But during this time, when I was off work and hurt, and I was talking to my sponsor, and prior to this, I had gone down to Tyler Junior College, and I'd got a 2-year associate's degree, which I found out is absolutely worth nothing in the job market. But anyway, I was talking to my sponsor, and whining to him, you know, about how bad things were and how nobody loved me. And my sponsor said, well, why don't you take advantage of this downtime that you're experiencing here? Go down to UT and get your bachelor's degree. I said, how? Are you crazy? Do you realize how old I would be when I got that degree? He said, yeah, you'd be the same age that you'd be if you didn't get that degree. Go figure, huh? And so that's what I did. And almost immediately upon getting that degree, my income tripled from what it had been prior to getting hurt and doing this. So, you know, you are given a power to change your life in here. If you stay sober, if you do the things that are laid out for us to do, if you practice these principles in all your affairs to the best of your ability, strange and amazing things just might happen in your life. They most certainly have in mind, let me tell you. But I'm going to leave you with one parting shot here, and I'll shut up because I'm in overtime. And I heard somebody say one time that to be seen, you stand up. To be heard, you speak up. And to be appreciated, you sit down. And so I'm going to sit down here in a minute, but I have come to believe that because of this program, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I have been given a whole new lease on life. And it never stops getting better, it seems. The problems keep arising, but life continues to get better. And I have every expectation that that will continue to happen to me as long as I stick with this program and do it to the best of my ability. And that is as Darrell sees it. Thank you.